support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has given a Marin therapist the green light to study whether the illegal drug ecstasy, or MDMA, is effective in treating severe anxiety and depression when taken in conjunction with psychotherapy. A notorious party drug, ecstasy has previously shown promise as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And we'll look at the latest MDMA studies and the increased medical interest in the drug, which was banned by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration in 1985. Join us for Forum. It's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In 1985, the U.S. government banned ecstasy, the psychoactive drug known medically as MDMA, and categorized it as a Section 1 drug, prohibited and labeled as easily abused and without medical value. Now, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has allowed for a study to investigate the effects of ecstasy on those suffering from anxiety, over cancer, or other life-threatening illnesses. The research project, under the leadership of a Marin County psychotherapist, will look at the drug's effectiveness in conjunction with psychotherapy. What will this mean, not only for the potential medical or psychodynamic uses of the illegal drug ecstasy, once the drug of choice at raves, and will it open up the possibility of additional research with other drugs which have been prohibited for use, even for research? Joining us to talk about this morning is Phil Wolfson. He is a psychiatrist and psychotherapist with the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, principal investigator in a new trial of MDMA, assisted psychotherapy for the treatment of anxiety in individuals with life-threatening illnesses, and author also of a book called Noe, a father-son song of love, life, illness, and death. And Phil Wolfson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Don Latin back with us on Forum, author, freelance journalist, former religious writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Latest book is Distilled Spirits, Getting High, Then Sober, with a famous writer, a forgotten philosopher, and a hopeless drunk. Welcome back, Don Latin.
Great to be here again, Michael.
Great to have you here. And we also want to welcome Elias Dakwar, who is with us from New York City this morning. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Welcome, Elias Dakwar.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you. Let me begin, Phil Wolfson, if I may, with you. And let's begin. This is really breakthrough stuff because this has been an outlawed drug for so long. You used it, I think, to some extent as a shrink before the illegal mark at 1985.
I like shrink. It's very nice. Yes, I did. I was very involved in the beginnings of this when we discovered the psychotherapeutic potential of MDMA, then known as Adam, later ecstasy, now Molly, etc. And we had some fabulous experiences using it, especially with couples for relationship issues. And hundreds of couples were seen in psychotherapy by a burgeoning group of practitioners between the early 80s and its classification as Schedule 1 in 1985. And we found it effective for depression, for anxiety, for PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, for a variety of interpersonal issues, because it expanded people's ability to understand and feel each other and feel themselves.
Breaks down inhibitions, really, to a great degree, doesn't it?
It makes you more accessible to your own negative feelings and thoughts so that they're not so toxic. You can process them better, and also makes you more aware of other people. And we called it an empathogen because it tends to generate just that empathy for ourselves and others. And unfortunately, that work, and we were in a steep learning curve, was cut off when it was scheduled.
Well, now, the study that you're going to do has to do with psychotherapy, but there's been reports that not only veterans suffering from PTSD, but sexual abuse victims, those on the autism scale, and at least the far, even the farther reaches of the autism scale, have been helped by MDMA?
That's correct. MAPS, the organization that's sponsoring our study, has been conducting studies since the late 1990s under FDA regulations. Much of those studies have focused on post-traumatic stress disorder, and a study that Michael Mithoffer, who's been the pioneer in this work in Charleston, South Carolina, is finishing is with vets. And we're particularly interested in helping veterans who are coming back from scarred experiences in wars such as Afghanistan and Iraq and have not been helped adequately, and there's such a high suicide rate. So that's been one series of studies. And then Charles Grobe and Alicia Danforth at UCLA Long Beach have just concluded a study on autism in high-functioning autistic people, which remarkably has shown that people who have had very little emotional experience can have significant emotional contact, breakthrough emotional contact with other people under the influence of MDMA, and afterwards holding on to that gain.
And MAPS is funding this study, as I said, before the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Don Lattin, how did ecstasy become illegal in Section 1? I mean, why did that happen if there was all of this positive stuff going on?
Yeah, well, it was. It's actually amazing it stayed legal as long as it did. You know, in the war, the so-called war on drugs in the 1960s, another long and very unsuccessful war this country has been involved in, they put a lot of drugs under Schedule One in 1970. People forget LSD was legal until 1966. And it was really the burgeoning use of MDMA, a.k.a. ecstasy, both among therapists but also among recreational drug users. I mean, this drug makes you feel really good. And that good feeling can be used by a trained therapist to help you really process and work with serious problems. And it can also just be a fun drug to take. And a lot of people were taking it recreationally or spiritually. Some people might call that drug abuse. Really, the popularity of it forced some in the federal government to feel that it had to be put under Schedule One and outlawed, which was such a shame, as Phil pointed out, because there was all kinds of great research and work being done in the late 70s and early 80s into beneficial uses of this medication. And it just was shut down for 20 or 30 years. And then this is part of a whole new wave. It's a really exciting time, Michael. There's a whole new wave of research into psilocybin, LSD, drugs like ketamine, all kinds of drugs that have been banned or discouraged over the last 20 or 30 years. It's an exciting time.
It is also a different time, maybe a different era, some are hoping, although ultimately whether or not things are going to open up in the way I know you and Dr. Wolfson would like to see is questionable. But there's a new head of FDA, and this is Chuck Rosenberg, who replaced Michelle Leonhardt, seems to be more open to the idea, at least, of this sort of thing. Program that Phil Wolfson is going to be heading up, though, was a month before that switchover in terms of DEA leadership. But maybe more psychedelics, maybe more experiments with these kinds of things. But we want to talk about some of the concerns that many people have, too, though. But yeah. Don, you know a lot about this area, so help us understand the difference between what's called MDMA on the one hand, the medical name, and ecstasy, and what's called Molly, the kind of thing that's used at raves. Because as I understand, there was one big batch. It's a pure batch. It was used back in Germany or in the turn of the century to essentially be an appetite suppressant. And that pure batch is still under lock and key?
No, not exactly. What happened is the drug was first synthesized in 1912 by a chemist working for Merck, a German chemical company. And they patented it back then. And it was briefly tested, I think, as an appetite suppressant. It was never, I don't think, marketed as an appetite suppressant. It was kind of forgotten about. And it was rediscovered by a chemist named Sasha Shulgin, who was out in Lafayette, who used to work for Dow Chemical. And he kind of rediscovered and kind of reinvented MDMA in the 70s. And that's when it became popular in the underground psychotherapy world. But the important thing to remember is most people who think they've taken MDMA probably haven't taken MDMA, because most of what you get on the
stuff
street,
they call Molly, is not real
MDMA.
You
buy anything, Michael. You buy anything on the street, you don't know what you're getting, and that's the
okay,
issue.
That's the big problem. And yeah. I mean, and there are other problems. We might as well go head on into them and address them. I mean, a lot of people are concerned, obviously, about children. In fact, there was just a death in England of a kid who thought he was taking ecstasy around the Thames. There was some party going on. I guess you would call it a rave. I know they use rave across the pond in England.
But actually, the rave thing started in England.
Oh, that's right. It did start in England. Yeah. But there's also, you know, concern about the addiction possibilities. There's concern about cardiac problems related to. I mean, there are a lot of concerns here. Yeah.
Can I address that?
Yeah,
Phil Wilson.
Actually, the addiction issue is bogus. There's been almost no addiction. The chemical itself does not lend itself to addiction, much as the chemical name is 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine. Its relationship in terms of neurotransmitter action to methamphetamine is pretty small. So it's primarily a serotonergic drug with some noradrenergic action. So people have not really gotten dependent or addicted to it, except in tiny, tiny numbers. People have used it frequently, but the tendency is that the day after or several days after, if you take it in succession, the drug actually doesn't do very much.
Even excessive amounts of it, ingesting
excessive amounts of it tend to make you have more side effects, like a jaw clench. It doesn't produce much more psychoactivity. So it's limited, actually, in that respect.
But you also want to limit it, assuming the trials go well and things move forward the way you'd like to see them move, with society being more enlightened about use, limit it to adults.
Of course. In 1985, when the DEA appointed an independent administrative law judge, in fact, the judge found for the utility therapeutically of MDMA, it had abuse potential, and the recommendation coming out of that was for Schedule 3. I was involved in trying to keep MDMA legal as a therapeutic tool, unsuccessfully, because the DEA overruled their own judge and put it into Schedule 1. There were several cases that pushed it out for a brief moment, and then the DEA again overruled it. But what I would comment on in terms of the FDA is that we're doing good science, and MAPS is behind doing really a fine, well-regulated, within conformity to FDA standards science. So the FDA is compelled, really, to look at this. They can't just overrule it and say, for political reasons, we don't want it.
Well, we're going to actually hear from Elias Dakwar about this. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry. He's with us from New York City, and he's at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. And I know you've used, Dr. Dakwar, this yourself, I don't mean personally, but in terms of mindfulness and enhancing mindfulness, and found it useful. But for widespread use, or for simply taking all of the kind of controls that are presently on this, is Section 1, are you in favor of that?
Well, I should clarify the research I'm doing. I'm looking at ketamine, which is a very different compound than MDMA. In a few respects, ketamine and MDMA have different neurobiological actions. They work very differently on the brain. And from a political perspective, they're very different because MDMA is Schedule 1, illegal. Ketamine is Schedule 3 and can be used medically. The government acknowledges medical use of ketamine, which makes research with ketamine much easier. But in another respect, they're similar in that they both produce altered experience. They both have mind-altering effects.
In fact, we could add mushrooms to that, too, psilocybin.
Right. There's an umbrella of agents, you know, designated by different names, be it psychedelic, entheogen, hallucinogen, psychotomimetic. They all seem to have this common effect of altering experience in such a way that it's comparable to non-ordinary states, like meditation, dreaming, trance, psychosis. And ketamine belongs to that list of compounds. And so the work I've been doing has really drawn from the recent work with ketamine in depressed individuals. So it's been found that a single sub-anesthetic dose of ketamine over the course of about 40 minutes leads to rapid and in some cases quite persistent antidepressant effects in individuals who hadn't responded to anything else. So quite a remarkable finding. Medications for depression usually take weeks to months to work. So this was quite a finding. And what I was interested in was how we might integrate ketamine into a psychotherapeutic framework to address, among other things, substance use disorders. And so my work has been aimed at using ketamine as an adjunct to mindfulness training. And mindfulness refers to this state we all have experienced of being non-judgmental, paying attention to what's going on a moment-to-moment basis, accepting whatever our experience brings up, a state of mind very similar to what Dr. Wolfson was referencing when talking about MDMA.
Actually, the word mindfulness, I think, goes back to Buddhist practice and being well-focused and all. But what about the research that Dr. Wolfson is doing? I mean, this is technically an illegal Section 1 drug, not like ketamine. So your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the big challenge here is that there has been a lot of promising work, both from the 50s and 60s and more recently in the 80s, suggesting that these compounds that are now criminalized and thought to have no medical value may be helpful. And so what do we do with this? You know, what do we do with this work that indicated there may be a therapeutic value to these compounds, and yet because of the use of these substances outside of medical settings and the kind of sensational stories of people developing psychotic problems, people having very profound issues with these drugs. Again, some of these stories were sensationalized.
Well, actually, I'm looking at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and these are reported undesirable effects up to 1 week post-MDMA or longer, and they list anxiety, restlessness, irritability, sadness, impulsiveness, aggression, potentially high blood pressure, heart failure, kidney failure, arrhythmia. I mean, these are all pretty sensational.
Right. Well,
that's from, again, the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
So yes.
But are they true?
Well, so MDMA has been found in some reviews to be associated with, among long-term users, deficits in memory. And there are also...
So are statins, studies, by the way, I think. Sorry.
There are also some studies indicating there may be mood problems associated with MDMA due to serotonergic disruptions. The latter hasn't quite been conclusively verified, but multiple groups have indicated that long-term users of MDMA do tend to develop memory deficits.
Dr. Wilson, your response?
You know, I've been around this a very long time, and I have a cohort of quite a few hundred people I watch, including myself, and I don't think I have or they have memory deficits. A lot of that work is challengeable. There was bogus work done by a fellow named Riccardi who had to retract it from Science magazine because he was dipping into a can of methamphetamine for his substance instead of MDMA. So there is definitely some sort of depletion effect short term. Some people even feel it 3 days later. Many people feel it for the day or two afterwards. But most people recover quite quickly from it, often don't have the day after and stay in the glow. I really am not aware of long-term deficits of memory or impairment of any real sort. That's not to say that the chemical can't have side effects or difficulties for people. It's called ecstasy, but not everybody has an ecstatic experience. A lot of people have an experience of depth and feeling. So I would dispute any long-term memory effects.
And Don Latton, you wanted to say something about ketamine?
Yes. I actually have my own story of trying ketamine recently. I'm doing a book on this new wave of psychedelic drug research, and I was going down to Brazil to take ayahuasca, which is a plant-based psychoactive drug. And somebody said I shouldn't be on antidepressants if I do this drug, and I was on antidepressants. I'd been on them for quite a few years. And to get off antidepressants, I stumbled across a doctor kind of serendipitously who said, you can get off antidepressants with one or two sessions of ketamine. This was a doctor in Hawaii. This is a year and a half ago, and he gave me an injection of ketamine. And it was a very powerful experience, an out-of-body, expansive experience.
More than ayahuasca?
much stronger than ayahuasca. Yeah, it turned out to be. Yeah, I took the ayahuasca later. And I used a combination of ketamine and ayahuasca in Brazil. Ketamine's legal here. Ayahuasca is legal in Brazil. And I've basically got off antidepressants, which I'd been on for years. And it's been 14, 15 months since I got off antidepressants. So I actually... can testify to the effectiveness of ketamine in helping people get off antidepressants.
But you would not – well, Elias Stockberg, I think your main concern with research with MDMA is who's doing the research and what they're going to be finding. Would you like, for example, the kind of research that Phil Wolfson's in charge of to move forward? Glad it got a green light?
Can I get a seal of approval?
That's a complicated question. I think these substances clearly have a way of attracting us. I mean, they create these states of mind that are quite powerful, and many of us who may be recreational users of them for various reasons would like to see them attain a more favorable role in our culture and in science. And this goes back to the catch-22 of what do we do with the fact that there is this very promising research that had been done in the 50s, 60s, and 80s. Recently, we were having some very promising results with psilocybin. What do we do with the fact that these substances are a priori dismissed as without medical value? What do we do with the lack of government funding for these kinds of studies? And invariably, we have to turn towards organizations that sidestep the usual funding mechanisms and solicit funds from people who are interested in seeing these compounds attain a more favorable status. So we're in this kind of problematic territory of certain agendas and political persuasions influencing the scientists who might be interested, for a good reason, in investigating these compounds.
And let me leave it there because I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. We're talking about the approval of ecstasy-assisted psychotherapy in Marin County, a study that's going to be headed up by Phil Wolfson, who's here with us in studio, along with Don Latton, who is author and former religion writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, but has written a great deal about this and this is his territory as well, his bailiwick. And Elias Dakwar with us by phone from New York, assistant professor of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. And you can join us, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can join us now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking about FDA approval of an ecstasy-assisted psychotherapy in Marin County. And That's being led by Phil Wolfson, who's here in studio with us, a psychiatrist and psychotherapist, funded by Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And many people feel that there really has not been enough funding for psychedelic studies or for research into drugs that were labeled illegal and are still really labeled illegal. Don Latin's also with us. His most recent book is called Distilled Spirits: Getting High, Then Sober, with a Famous Writer, a Forgotten Philosopher, and a Hopeless Drunk. And Elias Dakwar is with us by phone. He's Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. We're going to bring you into the conversation. And again, you can join us either by phoning us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Before I go to calls and emails, I wanted to go to North Carolina, actually, and welcome Nigel McCurry. He's an ex-Marine, and he got post-traumatic stress disorder after serving in Iraq in 2004 and took part in a clinical study in 2012, which used therapy and MDMA. And Nigel McCurry, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your symptoms, first of all. I mean, you were having some really serious and severe flashbacks from combat in Iraq, yeah?
Yes, I was.
And so how did you get involved in this clinical study?
Well, I got out of the Marines in 2005, and I had experienced PTSD symptoms from combat since I returned. And they got worse over time. It was 2011 where I finally went to the VA hospital because I didn't really know what else to do. And I went on the psychopharmaceuticals that they usually prescribe soldiers and Marines with PTSD, and I did the talk therapy. And after over 6 months of...
Sorry, we're having some problems. Okay, you just came back in. Yeah. We were losing you there for a moment. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry about that. After 6 months of trying what the VA had to offer, I wasn't really getting any positive effects, and that's where I heard about the study. So I researched what was going on, and it sounded like it was a potentially useful treatment, and I enrolled.
And how long were you treated with MDMA?
It was over the course of 6 months. I ended up doing 5 therapeutic sessions. Each session was an all-day event. They didn't give me MDMA to take home. It was only in a therapeutic setting. And the sessions were spaced out 1 month apart.
We should mention that there were dramatic effects in terms of the problems, not only with PTSD, but you were also, as I understand it, having serious sleep problems. And to a great extent, the PTSD anxiety that you were experiencing, as well as the sleep problems, were ameliorated?
Yes, well, I view it as it's all related to PTSD, the sleep problems especially. And I had not been able to go to sleep before 5 in the morning since being in combat in Iraq. After only the first MDMA session, my sleep dramatically improved, and I haven't had to take sleeping medication since then. That was about 3 years ago.
Side effects?
I experienced no side effects other than being emotional for a couple of months after the sessions were over, and I feel like that was a lot of emotions that I was keeping down coming up, but it was a very comfortable experience despite the fact that, you know, it was emotional.
You don't feel, or you didn't feel at any time, any dependency on the drug?
No, sir, not at all.
Okay. Well, we wish you ongoing success, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. Good to hear your story.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate being on.
That's Nigel McCurry, an ex-Marine who got post-traumatic stress disorder after serving in Iraq in 2004 and took part in a clinical study in 2012 using therapy and MDMA. And as you can hear, it's a bit of a success story. It is indeed a vanquishing of the PTSD syndromes with MDMA. Let's hear from you, our listeners, and we go to Sacramento. David, you're on.
Yes, earlier in the conversation, one of the guests said that the MDMA that they're using, or let me rephrase that, said that whatever you're getting on the street really isn't MDMA. It's not what they're actually using in the lab. And I'm just wondering, what's the difference and what is it actually that people are getting on the street?
Don, you want to handle that? I mean, they're getting a lot of MDMA on the street that's cut with speed, first of all, right?
Yeah, a lot of there have been, you know, tests done of illicit so-called MDMA. Often it's cut with speed. I saw one report that they tested MDMA ecstasy tablets and only 20% had any MDMA in them. So
that's, they don't know yet. This kid, as I mentioned, in England by the Thames, whether
yeah, that's
or not,
that's the problem with all these reports. You know, somebody dropped dead from a rave, and actually there were deaths at raves, but a lot of them were from dehydration because people would be up all night dancing and they'd be speedy either from the MDMA or from speed they thought was MDMA. So they're up dancing, they're sweating, and so there are a lot of factors. When you really look at the reports of these fatalities at raves, there's it's always more complicated than just MDMA.
Well, they didn't know what they were getting at raves either in terms of like the street stuff.
If I could add, the substance that we have was made in 1985. It's extraordinarily stable. It's been kept under DEA surveillance. It was made by Dave Nichols in 1985. And so we have a pure batch that survived over 30 years. But street adulterants are a major, major problem and a source of probably a lot of the deaths. The fellow in England who died was playing ball, and he had a sudden cardiac event. And I would imagine a contaminant that was probably a speed-like. There have been all kinds of contaminants.
There are also all kinds of problems with cardiac issues. And I'm looking actually at a listener sending this email in who writes, I'm 81, suffering from serotonin depletion depression. MDMA as a treatment looked very promising to me until I learned that a major possible side effect is that it might undermine the brain's further ability to produce serotonin. And that would make depression much worse.
No evidence for undermining the brain's serotonin production in an elderly person. You would have to be cautious, and there are blood pressure elevations running as much as 20 to 30 millimeters of mercury. So you would not want to do this if you were hypertensive or bordering on hypertension. But there's no permanent depletion in elderly that we know about any more than in young people. There's recovery if there is much depletion.
Of course, they're more vulnerable to cardiac problems at elder ages, obviously. Yeah. Let me get another caller on here. We're going to go to Stanford. Boris, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I unfortunately missed the beginning part of the program, but I my wife told me that MDMA was going to be the focus today. So I'm an anesthesiologist, MD, PhD at Stanford, and I'm also a postdoctoral researcher, and I'm working on MDMA to understand the pro-social mechanism of the drug in animal models. With, you know, again, all of our work has been basically ignited by this finding that it's so effective, or at least appears to be effective for PTSD, and now has some promise for social anxiety and other disorders. And one of the things I wanted to bring out, I mean, there are a lot of novel aspects to MDMA as therapy, but the one that is most striking as you think about the conventional model for PTSD therapy, and perhaps you've already covered this, but, you know, it's basically an SSRI, you know, like a Prozac or Lexapro, and, you know, months and months of talk therapy. And, you know, the problem with SSRIs is a lot of times, you know, you're not even sure if you're taking a drug. It takes a very long time for it to take an effect. And with MDMA, it's a single-shot therapy. There's nothing else like that in medicine. This is almost bringing a surgical-style approach of intervention to psychiatry, which is, you know, certainly where psychiatry needs to go. But beyond that, one of the things that has been remarkable is the MDMA is serving as a catalyst in therapy. At least this is something that the therapist can speak to more than I can. But by serving as a catalyst, it's not that the pro-social effect lasts, you know, forever and ever. It's, you know, just during the duration of therapy. By bridging the gap between therapist and patient, it demonstrates better than almost anything else I can think of how important talk therapy is. It actually is starting to give a biological relevance to talk therapy. So
I imagine it also speeds up the what we think of as a transference process that often goes on in traditional psychotherapy. Can I get you to weigh in here, Elias Dockwar, on this, especially about the single shot and catalyst that Boris, our caller, is talking about?
Well, yeah. So it's, as we were saying earlier, not quite the only medication that works in that way. You know, ketamine also has quite robust, rapid effects. But, you know, the point about how it might facilitate the therapeutic process is quite important. And I think as Nigel said earlier, you know, it's really about how the compound is administered, in what setting, with what intentions, that really makes the compound so effective. And with PTSD, one of the most effective types of therapy is a therapy aimed at extinguishing the negative reactions to the story, the images that might be associated with the trauma. And if ecstasy is able to help people with sitting with that kind of experience, with hearing the story again, with experiencing cues or images associated with the trauma, then it might facilitate the healing process. It might neutralize the narrative, the images that in someone with PTSD can cause so much distress and can generalize to create problems with trusting others, with experiencing the world as a healthy place.
Well, let me thank the...
And we know from pretty well-done research with MDMA that it does create an impression, you know, of people being more benevolent. There was a study done at University of Chicago exposing people to MDMA and asking them to rate how happy and kind faces looked. And there was an increase in how kind and benevolent these faces appeared to people on MDMA, which is an interesting finding and consistent with what Dr. Wolfson had mentioned earlier about creating a situation where previously negative things no longer have the kind of impact that they used to.
Well, you hear these reports of people on ecstasy who say they want to kiss everybody and they have great empathy and, you know, like I said, inhibitions suddenly seem to fall away. But here's a listener named Ben who writes, as someone who has suffered from moderate depression all my life, I have stayed away from ecstasy because of its effects on serotonin, often referred to as the Tuesday blues after a weekend of partying. But again, cautionary note here is we may not be talking about ecstasy as it's going to be used by Dr. Wolfson and different effects from other things at those rave parties and the likes. But here's some expression by a listener named Karen about concern for what you said earlier, Don Latin. Karen writes, whereas a ketamine injection may have helped your guest get off antidepressants, I'm shocked that he states this in such an irresponsible way. Depression is complicated. Medications for depression are complex and need medical assistance in discontinuing their use. Please tell your listeners not to experiment with this dangerous methodology.
Yeah. Well, I did actually titrate down on the antidepressants, and that's true. You have to be careful about this stuff. But there's a feeling out there that a lot of these antidepressants are basically placebos for many people, and there's a whole reexamination of how effective those drugs really are for some people. I mean, I didn't have serious depression, but I had moderate depression.
There's a lot of research that shows placebos are efficacious,
right?
Yeah, for sure. If I could comment a little bit about that, I think discontinuation or withdrawal syndrome in people on antidepressants has to be respected, and you need to taper medication, which we do in our studies. But all of these studies, including the ketamine work, which I'm doing, are embraced in an assisted psychotherapy format of an intensive nature. During the 80s, what we discovered was that the revolution in therapy was that you had to sit with people 3, 4, 5, 6 hours or more until people had finished their experience. And that produced an incredible kind of relationship benefit between therapist, patient, and an openness that ordinary 50-minute therapy couldn't provide. We're doing a journal coming out next week in the International Journal of Transpersonal Studies on ketamine-assisted psychotherapy being made into a book by MAPS called The Ketamine Papers, which I'm the editor of, which will come out in the fall. And that, too, is embraced within a psychotherapeutic format focused on transformative experiences. So none of this should be done irresponsibly, for sure.
You had a transformative experience. I mean, you've written this book. I've not had the opportunity to read it yet, but I would like to. In fact, came with the imprimatur of Isabel Allende, no less, urging me to read it. But as I understand it, I mean, you went through this heartbreak of losing a son, and you know, the impact of that can't even be, I think, expressed. It's ineffable. But you were helped by MDMA?
Thank you, Michael. Yes, in 1984, my oldest son, Noah, we call him Noe from Noe Valley, he was diagnosed with acute lymphocytic leukemia. We were in the midst of doing the psychotherapeutic work with MDMA, and I did write about this in the book. And so within our own family construct, we would use MDMA to facilitate warmth, time out, a break from the very, very awful struggles of chemotherapy and having a young adolescent in torment over his life. He died at almost age 17. So during the legal period, we were able to use this to facilitate developing our own harmony and integrity. The kids, of course, didn't use. But when Rick Doblin came to me and said, would you work on this study with life-threatening illness, it was a confluence for me because of my MDMA work and, of course, my own personal experience in working with people who were looking at death and recurrence, relapse of a life-threatening illness. So this is deep and compassionate work that we're doing, and I feel very grateful to be able to work in this way, combining what I learned and experienced with people who are struggling with life issues themselves.
I knew, by the way, when we decided to do this program, that there would be some criticizing, that we were sounding like we were giving approbation for drug use and all the rest of those sorts of things. And I think this next caller, Robert, has some of those concerns. Robert, join us. Hi.
Well, thank you. Exactly. I think that even mentioning that any of these substances may have a therapeutic value would be a justification for anybody who's struggling with addiction issues to experiment with these. I can say from my personal experience as an adolescent, reading the Carlos Castaneda books and thinking that I was going to have a transformative experience led me down a 30-plus year path of addiction. And anything that glorifies the notion, I support this idea. I don't think this is the proper forum for it. People that are suffering from life-ending, terminal illnesses, there may be a therapeutic usage. These things should be used in that, but this format is dangerous to people like myself.
Well, thank you for that. Appreciate your call. In fact, I'm going to follow that up with another caller, Lewis, who has a different perspective in terms of something in lieu of drugs. Lewis, go ahead.
Actually, it's Luis, and good morning. So I'm actually a researcher at UC Davis, and so I actually got diagnosed as having bipolar disorder 2 about 5 years ago, and I was actually on mood stabilizers for many years, and actually through relaxation and through empathy, actually, my girlfriend showed me a lot of empathy. I used to be very, very arrogant. I actually was able to stop cold turkey my medications because of other reasons. And shortly, not even 3 days later, I was actually able to fully recover because she taught me empathy. So I am now able to communicate well with people, and my productivity has increased by about 10 times of what it used to be. So what I am saying is I feel that empathy is the real reason why these drugs are working. So as Phil mentioned earlier, MDMA allows you to feel more emotion with other people. And just for my own experience, I feel that empathy has increased my horizons by 100-fold.
And you're saying you can do that without the help of or the assistance of something like MDMA. Okay.
Yes.
Luis, excuse me. Good to hear from you, and I appreciate your call. Rudy writes, I took LSD at a legal research clinic in Menlo Park around 1966. It was instant depression. I never got over it. I went nuts. My expectations were that this was supposed to make me into a better person. I felt like a worse person and felt that I had failed somehow during the experience. I took psychedelics on my own after that, and it was terrible. I kept getting worse. I lost my job, broke up with my girlfriend, etc. I'm very scared of anything that resembles LSD in any way. You get this kind of feedback, don't you, Don Lattin, from both sides?
Yeah. I mean, the previous caller talked about addiction. I mean, there's a very serious problem of drug addiction in this country. The main problem is with alcohol, of course, and cocaine and heroin and speed. There's actually been a lot of research into the use of psychedelic drugs to help addicts. Even Bill Wilson, my last book, Distilled Spirits, was about how Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, used LSD in the 1950s. He was already sober, but he was using it to help him with his depression.
How come nobody can use their name in Alcoholics Anonymous, but he used his?
That's a long story. Yeah. But anyway, my point is that there has been a lot of research and work in using psychedelic drugs in a therapeutic context to help addicts. And it's really what my take on these drugs, it's the insight you have into yourself, a new sense of yourself that you get. Yeah, there's some kind of brain chemistry going on. There may be a scientific explanation of the neurotransmission, but I think what's happening is it's insight into your problem. And if the problem is addiction, a new way of looking at that. And so it's not so simple that all drugs are bad. All drugs can be addictive. As a matter of fact, these drugs can help a lot of people with their addiction using having the sort of spiritual insight and spiritual experience that they talk about in the 12-step program. And an authority no less than Bill Wilson believed that.
Well, can I adjust?
Yeah, go ahead, Joel Wilson. Phil Wilson, excuse me.
Set and setting are critical to what people experience. The last call is unfortunate experience. People have unfortunate experiences. It is important to emphasize to anyone using drugs on their own that they're in a good setting, have a good frame of mind, have support, have people around them. And that really does help have a more higher probability of a positive experience.
But you can have bad experiences with SSRIs. You can also have, can you not, or need to make a distinction between the use of something like ecstasy and LSD?
As a practicing psychiatrist, of course, you can have bad experiences with all of the pharmaceutical drugs, and they do produce them. There's warnings about suicidality early on in SSRI, SNRI usage. So no drug is a perfectly linear, oh, it's all taking us to beautiful life. So we have to be careful about what we learn, what we think, and where we use them.
I want to bring another caller on here from Roanoke, Virginia. We're joined by Forrest. Good morning. I'm sorry. It's we're going to Mountain View first. Gagan Dedden. I'm sorry. What's your?
Yeah. Hi. This is Gagan Shah.
Dedden. Okay. Go ahead.
Mountain View. I just had a small comment to make that a lot of the research that we're hearing here is around, is from the United States and from the last few years, most like last two decades. But if you look at spiritual researchers over the last millennia. From India and other places, they have explored these kinds of substances. I don't know if they particularly looked at ecstasy, but the overwhelming conclusion, if you read Kabir, Nanak, or any other saint or spiritual person, is that yes, these might help you temporarily, but the real solution to a lot of your psychological problems, like the previous caller suggested, is in practicing proactive empathy. So, these could help, but they don't necessarily, last long term. That's more of a, anecdotal evidence from whatever they've written.
All right, Gagan, I appreciate that, and we'll let that stand. I want to get this caller on from Roanoke, and that's Forrest. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Join us, please.
I'm actually a researcher, a graduate researcher, and I study the way media affects the approval of medications and such. And I was wondering, the researchers there have talked about, and psychiatrists have talked about all the positive results of their research, but, I mean, they briefly mentioned some, like they had one caller talk about negative lasting effects, but I was wondering, do you think that if any kind of, since this, these drugs already have such a bad street rep, that if there's any tiny little hiccup or one small, you know, people are going to look for any kind of reason to derail this kind of further of this research. I was wondering if they could comment on that.
Well, we have. Thank you for that, Forrest. We have talked about concerns about cardiac problems and the like. Elias, Doc, want to go into any other details in terms of the negative?
That's an important question. And, you know, as responsible researchers, we have to be aware of what the risks of the compounds we're investigating are and design our studies in such a way that those risks are minimized. And, you know, some common safeguards to ensuring that these substances don't create more risks in our study populations than they have to, we select the people that we give them to. We select for people who aren't likely to have psychotic reactions, either you know, having a family history of psychosis or having a history of psychiatric problems themselves that might lead to psychosis, having a previous history of abusing these substances. And, you know, even though these substances don't cause physiological dependence, substances like MDMA, LSD, they can be abused and used in a way that might lead to problems. You know, we've heard about people using them in at parties and not drinking enough and developing cardiovascular hyperthermia type responses. So we have to be aware of these sorts of risks and design our studies accordingly.
I think that's an important point. We've got seconds left here, Elias Dagwar, so I just want to have Phil Wilson tell us, where are you now in this project?
We're in the process of screening people for our 18-subject study. We've already brought in about 4 people. We're looking for subjects. We're getting lots of calls and interest. We're giving a talk on this on June 4th at the Unitarian Church at 7:30 in San Francisco. So we're in active involvement.
And let me mention your book again, Noe, A Father-Son Song of Love, Life, Illness, and Death. Thank you, Phil, for being with us.
Thank you,
Don Latin. Thank you, Elias Dagwar, and thanks also to Nigel McCurry. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. We have another hour of forum that's coming up ahead. Stay tuned for that. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.